Welcome to the final episode of Grading Garpacks, an exclusive series of the Rebuildable podcast. I'm your host, Matt Gentile, and we are here in our fifth and final episode, and I wanted to do this as a recap show to explain my reasoning behind doing this series and kind of give you my final thoughts on that 16-year reign of both John Paxson and Gar Forman. So, of course, we had started this out with an overview. We brought in Jack Silverstein to really set the stage. We went over just the entire 16 years from 2003 to the present, talked about some of the moves from just a broader approach. And I thought it was a good way to sort of get everybody into that mode and kind of go back in history. Jack's really good at putting things into a historical perspective. I mean, he is a Chicago sports encyclopedia and historian, and so I thought, you know, that's the perfect type of guest to have on to really set the stage for everything, and he did a fantastic job with us on that. But the next three episodes 2 through 4, we really got into the nitty-gritty of all the different moves John Paxson and Gar Forman have made since they took over. I really thought by grading those different moves that it would help sort of slow things down, because I think if we just graded Gar Paxson in one episode and we went through every single move, there would be things you're going to miss out on. There's going to be things you forget. Just, it's natural. You're only going to focus on the notable moves made throughout a whole 16-year run. I thought, you can't really do that. Because the other thing about Gar Paxson is they've been through different iterations of a rebuild. You think about the moment John Paxson walked in and was really leading the charge early on. That was a whole different setup. That was a whole different team. By the time Derrick Rose came in, it was a whole different team. It was a different style that they built. And now, what they're building is completely different. So, I thought it was best to break it up that way. And so, what we did, of course, in episode 2, we had Doug Tonis and Mark Karanzoulis, two really prominent Chicago Bulls podcasters who really love that early part of the John Paxson reign. They've really always have spoken glowingly about that period in their work. They came on to help grade that portion of Bulls basketball from 03 to the end of the 08 season. In episode 3, we had on C-Dub and Big Dave Watson, hosts of the Ball on Bulls podcast. And we went over probably one of the best times of the Gar Paxson era, the time where Derrick Rose was at his peak. Tom Thibodeau was the head coach. He had Joakim Noah playing his best basketball. Luol Deng was coming into his own. Probably the closest team that was a Eastern Conference and a title contender. So that had a whole different set of moves that were worth exploring and grading. And of course, our latest episode with C. Red Friend and Matt Peck, which was a fun debate for most of it, we looked at 2014, that offseason, to the present day. And that's kind of, that last period there really is a play in two acts when you look at everything pre-Jimmy Butler trade and post-Jimmy Butler trade. But looking at everything, I thought in those little chunks would not only give you an insight into the good and the bad of Gar Paxson, but I also thought it would really help show that they've sort of followed a blueprint since day one. Yes, they've built teams a little differently here and there, but there is sort of a blueprint with the way that John Paxson, Gar Forman have built these teams. That there's a pecking order involved, that they really do believe in building from the ground up in the draft. In all three episodes where we graded, episodes 2 through 4, when we graded, the drafts tended to be pretty highly rated. And one of the reasons is they really have, I think, over the last 16 years, tried to build this thing through the draft. I think they have. So the biggest issue, though, I think that kept coming up when we would review was trades and free agency. Trades and free agency were always something where it was an incomplete mission. An incomplete mission. I think that's the best way to describe it. They were really good at finding role players. They still are really good at finding role players. This past offseason, when you really look at it, Thad Young, Tomas Satoransky, great role players to add onto this young core to complement your young pieces. But being able to go and get that final big fish has eluded the Chicago Bulls. It has. It's the one thing that Garpax haven't done over the last 16 years. That's fair to say. It's just the truth. They did have Derrick Rose. And we could talk about whether or not, you know, lucking into the number one pick, you know, if you deserve credit for that. I think you deserve credit for not falling into the Michael Beasley hype. And I certainly feel that at the end of the day, they still picked that player. So props for that. And you ended up with a really good player who helped change your franchise. But even then, did they really capitalize on that moment? I don't think they did. And I think in that episode, you know, Big Dave and C-Dub agreed that they really didn't capitalize on that moment. They didn't make that one extra move to put the team over the top, to play alongside Derek, to be the alpha with Derek, or the number one with Derek, or even a really good number two with Derek. They never really got to that point. You know, Joe Kim Noah was a really good defensive player and a really good passing big man on offense. Luol Deng was a really good slashing corner three-point shooting specialist at small forward on offense and a really good defender on the other side of the ball. But he wasn't a superstar. He just wasn't. And then you look at, by the time Jimmy Butler evolved into what he evolved in as an all-star, Derek was already a shell of himself at that point. So the Bulls never really did make those final moves to get him to go over the top. So I guess this series really helped paint that picture, because I think there are some fans in Bulls Nation who think that people like me, Matt Peck, some of the ones that are a little frustrated, they think we're being pessimistic. And I kind of wanted to show that it really wasn't pessimism. It was more skepticism. Because I honestly believe, in a vacuum, John Paxson and Gar Foreman have actually done a pretty good job. A pretty good job. Now, we did this on scale of 1 to 5 for different categories. If you've been listening to the previous episodes, you know, we graded the drafts, free agency moves, coaching decisions, trades on scale of 1 to 5. And so when you add it up, it tends to be lower as a grade. So like if you were in school, you'd be giving them a D a lot. And I guess looking back on it, I probably would have just said, hey, give me your letter grade. But I wanted people to be a little more honest. But I guess if you were to put a letter grade, I'd say Pax, Gar, probably get a solid B. Honestly, they get a solid B for all the moves they made over the course of 16 years. I guess the problem, though, is should you get 16 years to try and win a championship, to try and build a title contender? That's the million-dollar question. It's the one that I can't answer. It's the one that I feel like no Bulls fan really knows, because we don't know the conversations that happen inside the Advocate Center. We just don't. We can assume that the Reinsdorfs only love to fill up the seats at the United Center, and that's why they don't really care. And there are times where I tend to buy into that narrative. In fact, I probably subscribe to that narrative quite a bit. And then I think there have been instances where Jerry Reinsdorf shows his competitive side, where he does want to win with both of his teams in town. And I think, well, you know, maybe he wants to have his cake and eat it too. Maybe he really just is too loyal. Maybe he does have friends and he doesn't want to let them down. But as Bulls fans, it's hard. And I guess what I was trying to show is that we can be conflicted. We can be. That what's happening with the Chicago Bulls for the better part of 16 years could make us so happy and enjoy all these moments, you know, early in the rebuild when Pax was really the lead guy in charge, when it was Kirk Heinrich, Luol Deng, Ben Gordon, those teams that we talk about in episode 2 when we grade those moves, that you could enjoy watching that team that John Paxson resurrected, that you could enjoy that whole process, and it was the most fun you could have, but that it reaches a shelf life. What we talk about in episode 3 with Derrick Rose, guy with all-star and superstar ability, watching that team rise with Joe Kim Noah and Luol Deng and a really good coach in Tom Thibodeau, that you can watch this team get to a certain point, and the experience was a lot of fun, and you watch them go toe-to-toe in the regular season with the Miami Heat, with the Big Three, with LeBron and Dwayne Wade and Chris Bosh. And, you know, in that first season where Derrick Rose won the MVP in 2011, they could sweep them in the regular season and then whoop their butt in Game 1 of the Eastern Conference Finals before losing the next four, of course. But all of that stuff was enjoyable, but it reached a shelf life. At one point, we as Bulls fans said, hey, something else needs to happen. So I think it's important to understand, we've seen the track record. You know, the pendulum has swung back and forth for the last 16 years. What we're hopeful for, what I'm hopeful for, is that this time, with Lauri Markkanen, Zach LaVine, Wendell Carter Jr., Kobe White, that we can find the last piece to the puzzle, finally. Finally. I guess doing this whole Rebuildable podcast, for starters, sort of was a way of presenting this point continuously, that the rebuilds are fun to watch. The rebuilds are enjoyable. But damn, could it finally yield the result we'd love it to yield? And that's raising the seventh banner at the UC. That's the point. That's why I did this. A lot of my friends that listen to the podcast, they ask me, what was the inspiration behind doing this series? The Grading Garpacks series. Like, they knew my reasoning why. But what spurred it? Like, what spurred the decision to do it? Well, I think I should pull back the curtain just a little bit. Our third episode of the whole Rebuildable podcast, I had John Sabine on from Bulls Outsiders on NBC Sports Chicago. He came on to give his rebuilding plan. And usually I do this thing where in those episodes for rebuilding plans, I set up the scenario of, you know, that guest taking the position of general manager, VP of basketball ops, whatever. And I had mentioned about John Paxson being in charge for the last 16 years. And John's reaction to that is what spurred this whole idea of doing this series. I'm actually going to play that for you right now. So this is what John said, and this was the conversation he and I had right when I had brought up the fact that Paxson had been in charge for the last 16 years.
It's 16. I mean, that is amazing to think about it.
16 years. And you think about it, they've had like three phases of rebuilds, right? You had the one initially with Ben Gordon, Lou Alding, Kirk Heinrich.
Oh, I love.
The Scott Skiles Bulls.
The Scott Skiles. But Scott Skiles, it's so funny. You look at Scott Skiles, you look at Boylan right now. It's like, those are the same coaches. It's just the same guy, right?
Well, think about it. I mean, what was John Paxson like as a player? You know, a real try-hard, gritty type of guy, right? Played with a lot of spirit. And think about who he tends to like as head coaches. Scott Skiles, Tom Thibodeau, now Jim Boylan. So I think there's something to that. The Bulls are always looking for that kind of guy to lead the charge, it seems like. So
I agree with you. And when people voice their frustrations with Paxson, people are always saying, well, why does he want to do this? Like, people hate him. And I was like, this guy doesn't quit. He doesn't quit. His whole career is like succeeding and not quitting and not giving up. Like, that's his mentality. You know, he's an athlete, you know?
Oh, true. And, you know, when he first, like in his first 5 years as a general manager, before he moved up to VP of basketball ops, you know, his big issue was that he had trouble negotiating contracts with players' agents. Mm-hmm. And I saw a story from the Tribune about, I think it was a year or two ago, and they mentioned that Paxson actually went to Jerry Krause and asked Jerry Krause what his contract should be. So that's the kind of guy he is. You know, he's very old school, team driven, team oriented type of guy. And I think in today's NBA, I don't know if that just plays well.
So right there, John's reaction to that and the conversation we had spurred this Grading Garpacks series. What I want to do now, though, is I want to play some of the bonus sound. You know, you might have noticed a lot of these episodes were longer. They were two-part episodes where we got into the grading, episodes 2 through 4. And I have some bonus sound I want to play for you guys from episodes 2 and 3. Episode 4 with Matt Peck and C-Red Fred, those were so good that I really did not cut anything substantial from that. But in the discussions I had with Doug Tonis and Mark Karanzoulis in episode 2, and with Big Dave Watson and C-Dub in episode 3, I thought there were some interesting gems and interesting points that were made that I want to play in this recap episode. So I want to start with something from episode 2. I cut out a question that I had asked about the pursuit the Bulls had for Kobe Bryant in the year 2004. So not 2007 when Kobe was pining to be traded from the Lakers, but when it looked like a possible divorce with the Lakers was happening and Kobe was a free agent. The Lakers ended up trading Shaquille O'Neal to the Miami Heat, and that opened the door for Kobe to come back because there was, of course, friction between those two. But at that time, Kobe was negotiating with some teams, including the Chicago Bulls, and there was talk that Kobe was looking for, you know, schools in the area, thinking about house shopping. So this is the discussion from that. I'm going to start with Doug Tonis' answer to my question about how that could have changed the luck of the Chicago Bulls.
Well, I kind of will jokingly say this is similar to where I said, why didn't the Bulls trade up for LeBron? I mean, yeah, if you could have gotten Kobe Bryant in 2004, that would have been absolutely amazing. But I just don't see there's any way to think that that was going to really happen. I think even with history, we know that was never going to happen. If it could have happened somehow, it would have been incredible. I just think there was no realistic thing about that.
One thing that I will add to this is this has been mentioned by Kobe Bryant himself, not the 2007 stuff, but 2004. He did say that he and his wife were looking for schools in the northern suburbs. And there have been reports from, again, David Aldridge, I remember, was the big reporter at the time covering this story, and did say that it was pretty close had the Lakers not been able to trade away Shaquille O'Neal. So I'm just putting that one note in there.
Let's say it could have happened, it would have, right? Like, if the Bulls could have made it happen, they would have done it. The Lakers eventually stepped up and did the things that they needed to do to make things work for them. And, yeah, it would have just been amazing. If we could have gotten Kobe Bryant in his prime, it would have been an incredible win for Chicago. And if you could have signed him that year, knowing the guys you were able to draft, you know, how great would that group have been? You know, it would have been incredible. But it just was not to be, as it so turns out.
Yeah, and to back onto what Doug sort of just mentioned there, we think about maybe the Bulls, but it was maybe 2 weeks ago, maybe a week ago, there was a story about the Clippers, and this was post sure. Kawhi Leonard and Paul George coming in, that Kobe, I don't know if it was a recent interview or not, but he mentioned that he was extremely close to signing with the Clippers in 2004, and there was a few key officials back then with the Clippers as well, thinking they had that over the line as well. So I'm probably more inclined to think that the Bulls, if nothing else, maybe the Clippers too, were more so a leverage play than anything else. I think Kobe always wanted to stay in LA, whether it was between him and Shaq. I think that's probably more of I think he was just playing the game to eventually get his way, which he ultimately did, but I don't necessarily see this as a situation where the Bulls were realistically in the game. I know it could have theoretically lined up, but ultimately, based on what Kobe has said about the Bulls in the past, now what he's saying about the Clippers now, I think it's just it's very convenient, I'll put it that way.
It would have been interesting with that young core. If we were to play it theoretically, if he was on that team with Heinrich, Gordon, Deng, that would have been, I think, a pretty special group.
I mean, it would have been a different group, that's for sure. It would have been a different era. I mean, it changes everything about the franchise and where the franchise even now may be situated. So you bring in a player like Kobe Bryant, it changes the entire direction of your franchise. So it would have been fun. It would have been interesting to see. But I never put too much energy into that because I was always of the opinion, or at least thought, that the Bulls probably weren't really a realistic chance. So I haven't necessarily gone down that path of thinking about where it could have gone, because to me it wasn't like 2010. I'll put it that way. I went down the path with LeBron and Dwayne Wade, maybe a little bit too hard, a little bit too far. But with Kobe, I never got there. So even thinking about it now, or trying to relive that thought, it wasn't something that I had permeating throughout my mind too heavily at that point.
The irony I'll add, and I also agree with you, I don't think much about it, but if you did want to go down that path, the irony is that the Grizzlies wanted Deng and Gordon for Pau Gasol, and if you had Kobe Bryant and Kirk Heinrich and Nocioni and Duhon and these other guys, that may have been a trade that made a lot of sense, and then you would have been rolling with the pair that ended up winning two titles for the Lakers in just a different order. And I think that would have been, you know, kind of funny if you went that way. But I agree. I don't think there's any real way it was going to work out. I do think it was just leverage for Kobe to get his way with the Lakers, which he ultimately did.
So in that same episode, Doug Tonis relayed a story. It was a story about his time at Draft Express during the 2006 draft, which involved Tyrus Thomas, who the Bulls ended up acquiring in a draft day trade with the Portland Trail Blazers that year. And this experience sort of made him think twice about Tyrus Thomas entering the draft. Go ahead, take a listen to this. It's actually a really fascinating story.
I want to add one little just personal story. So at the time that this draft was going down, I worked at Draft Express. I don't know if you guys are familiar with it from back in the day, probably if you were watching basketball back then, but that was where you got all your draft content, and Jonathan Givony and I were attached at the hip. I did all the technical work. He did all the kind of the business end, and we had an interview scheduled with Tyrus Thomas because we had moved him to seventh in the mock draft at one point. And, you know, Tyrus completely flipped out, and we were going to go to camp, and Jonathan explained to his agent, like, hey, we haven't seen you yet. We moved you here based on the guys we've seen, and we've been to a bunch of private workouts, and it let us see your workout, and, you know, we'll see where we move you afterwards. And Tyrus refused to talk to us after being moved down on the mock draft and refused to let us see his workout in his interview. And then, you know, he wouldn't, like, talk with anyone. And he was very famously distrustful of the media. And I think, you know, he had whatever poor experiences. And, you know, I certainly saw that firsthand. And when I heard that story, I was just like, oh, my God, this guy is, like, really – you know, he's got some mental problems, and not like mental problems in it, but he's got trust issues. He's not someone who's coming in with like a right head on their shoulders in terms of how to approach the league and how to approach things, being a professional and these other things. And it just set me off with this other kind of just weird fear that like, this is like not a guy who's going to fit in really great in a locker room. And I used to have media access for the Bulls starting in around 2006. And so I've interviewed pretty much every player from 2006 to around 2012. And Tyrus is one of two people that was pretty much consistently just kind of like a jerk. Like every single other person I interviewed on the Bulls was at least just kind of somewhere from really great or to okay, you know, somewhere in that range. And Tyrus was like the one guy who was just incredibly standoffish. I did know a couple of friends of his people who are friends with him, and they said he is a super, super nice guy. He just has a very small inner circle, and if you're in the circle, he's great, and he loves to help out kids. He does all kinds of charity work on the side, so like he's not a bad guy, but that he just did not at all let anyone in the circle. It was just kind of a weird thing, and I don't know if that means anything about the pick, but I just thought it was an interesting time I could share this where it'll probably never make any sense to say it again afterwards.
I think it does mean a bit, Doug, because I think it speaks to his maturity and who he wanted to be as a player and those sorts of things. Because I don't think it was ever about talent with Tyrus Thomas. I mean, he could have been a damn good player. And maybe if he had a different head on his shoulders, Paxson would have been vindicated in this trade. But I think the maturity of who he was as a player and who he wanted to be as a player ultimately held him back. And maybe if that wasn't there, maybe it was a little bit different, this whole trade and this whole situation. And this whole era looks a whole lot differently, but we got to remember at the same time as well. I mean, if we think back, Tyrus didn't want to be a power forward, and that's ultimately what the team drafted him to be, but he wanted to be that star wing player. And maybe if he just accepted who he could have been rather than who he wanted to be, things look completely different. So to me, when you tell me that story, it sort of leans back into some things that I question about, like his general maturity and how he handled himself with the team post being drafted. And what you sort of just mentioned there was just a microcosm of things to come.
So of course, in each of these episodes, I asked for final thoughts to wrap up each period with sort of a summary on it. But in that second episode, what I left out of the final cut was a question I asked both Mark and Doug about whether this current young core has a higher ceiling than the one of Kirk Heinrich, Lou Alding, and Ben Gordon from 03 to 08. And it actually spurred a fun discussion from a question that Doug asked about whether or not it's more fun to have a one-hit wonder title team like the Toronto Raptors this past season, or a young try-hard group like those early Packs and Bulls teams. So this is first Doug's answer about the ceiling of this core. It goes into Doug's follow-up question, and then Mark is going to answer the question about the ceiling. So here you go.
Well, I think they have a higher ceiling, only in that we don't know where their ceiling is yet, right? We can now look back and say what we think the Baby Bulls ceiling was because we've seen all their careers play out. But if I was to compare the team going into this season to, say, the Baby Bulls going into the 05-06 season, you know, after they had that 47-win season, I would have absolutely told you that 04-05 team going into 05-06 had a much higher ceiling than this group. It's just history has proven that that team ceiling really wasn't that high, and I sure as heck hope that this current group has a higher ceiling than what those guys have proven to have in hindsight.
So to answer that question, I mean, if we think about the Baby Bulls era, they maxed out as a 49-win team. They went to the second round. They lost in the second round. That's kind of where I have this current iteration of Bulls sort of headed. I mean, unless something breaks differently, at least based on my projections of these players, based on my forecasting of where this team may sort of situate themselves in the next sort of 3 to 5 years, I kind of have them being a 50-win team. And that was very similar to what the Baby Bulls were. Maybe this iteration of Bulls will have a longer period of success. So like we said, it was only really, you know, 2 or 3 seasons that this team sort of had to play out as a potential playoff contender. Maybe, hopefully, this team that we're sort of currently living through now has a little bit more sustained success. But ultimately, based on what my projections right now, based on what we've sort of seen right now, I would sort of say they're sort of trending down the same path. But to Doug's point, we know what the Baby Bulls era sort of amounted to itself, and in large part it sort of ended quite quickly, and maybe that will happen again with this team, because I don't know. I mean, are the Bulls going to be prepared to pay Larry Markkanen the money that he wants? And if he wants a max extension, the Bulls don't necessarily want that. And, you know, the point is it can change pretty damn quickly, as we sort of saw with this Baby Bulls era. So whilst we're sitting here quite comfortably enjoying this current rebuild, it can change pretty quickly. But to answer your question, I think it's probably more likely to max out in the same way that this Baby Bulls era did. And to my point earlier, I mean, I said there were a lot of similarities between the situations, and I think ultimately their peak may be another one we can draw at the end of the day.
Can I ask you guys one question?
Sure.
And I think this goes back to something Mark said about how strongly we feel about this team, and I noted that this is one of my favorite Bulls teams of all time. 10 years from now, do you think Toronto Raptors fans of this will look back at this past season where they won the title with more fondness than Bulls fans kind of like in their prime Bulls fan era would look at this 2004-05 team? And because I kind of wonder, like, you had Kawhi Leonard for just 1 year and then he left. Like, you're not going to celebrate, you know, you celebrate this for like a moment, but like, how does that resonate with you in the long run? I just kind of wonder because there's no permanence to it at all.
I think though in Toronto, the fact that they had never experienced a championship, I think that's going to stick with them for a long time because, you know, they might never get that opportunity again. We had 6 of them. And I think that might be the biggest factor there is that Raptors fans are always going to have that championship. And to me, I value championships, so I probably would say I'd rather have the ring, but I'm curious what Mark has to say about this.
Yeah, I mean, I don't want to sound like a broken record, but I've mentioned it a few times, but like every individual has their own criteria of everything. Some people are title or bust, others are not. I'm not necessarily a title or bust person. If you're putting out a good product on the floor, something that I can reasonably justify pouring 2.5 hours into each game, then that's kind of what I enjoy. If that maxes itself into a title, then, you know, obviously that's great. But if you can have 3, 4, 5 years of sustained success as well, then there's value in that too. Like, I mean, if I think about the Thunder fans, for example, they never got a title, but they lived through some pretty damn great years where they were constantly competing for titles. So are they wrong to think that, I don't know, that their justification of that team was is less important than, you know, a team that's sort of like the Raptors who had won a great season, won a title and got value out of that? But how you weight that ultimately is an individual assessment. I don't think there is a right or wrong answer, but it's an interesting conversation to have. Obviously, the immediate impulse is to say if you end a season with a title, then that should amount to something more. But at the same time, I think there's more context to be had there, and ultimately, it's a personal decision.
Yeah, I don't know myself, which is why I asked the question. I was just thinking, if we got Anthony Davis this offseason and we won a title and then the team just completely fell apart afterwards, like how I would look back at that afterwards. And I don't know. And I think you make a great point, Matt. If it's your first title ever, you probably feel quite a bit differently about it than you might otherwise. Either way, thank you for humoring me. I was just curious your guys' thoughts.
Okay, so I got one more for you. This is from episode 3 with Big Dave Watson and C-Dub. We talked about Derrick Rose, and these were some of the thoughts we had about just how special Rose was before the injuries. So take a listen. Try not to get too depressed.
His shot, the shots he threw up there was so weird looking and so athletic and herky-jerky. It was unique. You know, there are every place where they have a style about it. He had a style about him. Unique style, a style that he didn't try to have. It's just natural within his game. And I remember I was here. I don't know if you call this, Dave, but you know, just talking about the fastest players in NBA, Westbrook. And I'm like, come on, please. I seen Westbrook around. He's not as fast as Derrick Rose. Then they played against each other. Yeah, that was obvious who was the fastest player in the NBA. I mean, Derrick Rose was like, I'll tell you to this day, I have never seen anybody as fast at the basketball than Derrick Rose. Like. And I seen him run as hard as he could one time. It was like before the whistle blew. He just ran as fast as he could for some reason. He has not ran that fast before in the NBA, which meant that he was holding back. Yeah. Like, he's literally holding back his speed. He was a phenomenal athlete.
And the thing that he also brought, Chris, that and Matt, that we hadn't seen before, the dude was a layup artist. Like, mm-hmm. I hadn't seen anybody be that amazing and that dynamic with layups than Derrick Rose. Kyrie Irving is the only other one I could think of. And he came up, you know, kind of with D Rose with that. But Derrick, you couldn't believe that the ball went in. Like, you see him go in among three people who are much, much bigger and taller than him. And he contorts his body and puts a certain kind of spin and English on the basketball and would finish every time with either hand. On either side of the rim, it was insane.
He was a contortionist, too. Like, that was the thing that was so impressive, is that he could change the ball midair in his hands. And, you know, you're right. He had that weird spin, too. And I remember he used to do it with some of those floaters in the lane at 6'3". Oh,
yes. Yeah, absolutely. Just, right. Those floaters were amazing. He would jump as high as he possibly could and throw, like, a floating skyhook. And it was like, what? And they would be game-winning shots. And, yeah. And it would go in. I remember he did that against the Lakers Christmas Day game. Like, that was insane. Like, he threw a hook, a hierarchy hook. He did it against the Knicks. Mm-hmm. I mean, it was just incredible to watch and incredible to see. And you're right, Chris. Like, he was just so unique. Like, that stuff is unique. That stuff you don't see. That's once in a generation kind of talent and kind of basketball that you just do not see.
I'll never forget the back scratch dunk he had against Goran Dragic. I feel like it made Stacey King famous.
Wow, yo, that is an excellent point. Oh my goodness, that is a great point right there. Yeah. You're absolutely right. I want to take it higher. Yeah, yes. What are you doing, Goran Dragic? Like, yeah, yo, that
did
is
you
so
not get
true.
The memo?
Right, that is so true. That is a great. I never even thought of that like that before. But yeah, that definitely put him on the map. And plus the fact that it was getting repeated and run back so many times. You know what I'm saying? Yeah, like, yeah, that definitely helped jumpstart that. Wow, that is a great point, man. Great point.
And then Mark Jackson start ripping off Stephen King.
right.
shout out to Van Gundy for calling him out on national TV. He was like, what are you doing, Mark? That's Stephen King stuff.
That's Stephen King stuff. Right, yeah. I want to know the look on his face when he said that. That would have been great.
The nerve of the dude. Well, shut up.
I often look back at that era, and that's the first thing I think about is D. Rose, and it's hard not to. I'll start with you, Dave. Where would you rate him on your all-time list of Chicago Bulls?
For me, he's number 3. It's Mike and his Pip to start it off. For me, he's definitely number 3. I haven't had that much joy watching basketball, and that much, I shouldn't even say joy, but I should say confidence, that, you know, when you watch Mike and you watch Scotty, you had confidence when you stepped on the court that you were going to win the game. You knew how the game was going to go, and you knew you were going to see something spectacular. You weren't going to see something, you know, comically bad, or, you know, man, I hope we win this game, or, you know what I'm saying, things like that. When you had Derrick Rose out there on the court, you're like, oh, yeah, we're coming to win. Oh, yeah, we're coming to smash these guys. And then he carried that whole Chicago mentality, and he was that to a T. How he took it personal when teams came to his city and they went out to the club the night before they played him. He took that personally. He didn't like it at all. Didn't care. At first, he was serious, like, I don't want to recruit. You know what I mean? Let's win with the guys we got. You know, that's the mentality. That's a very Chicago mentality. Wanting to play hurt and wanting to play injured and giving everything he had on the court. And, you know, just that kind of feeling and that kind of guy was something we hadn't had in this city since we were winning championships. And so to have him, and then him being actually from here, that kids, you know, can actually look at him and be like, yeah, I understand that because I grew up like that. I'm in that situation now. I got some hope, you know what I'm saying, looking at Derrick Rose. He meant so much to the Bulls, but he meant just way more to the city. And, yeah, so for all of those reasons and many more that I can't even think of right now, and Dub will probably touch on more of these, but he's number three on my list, though. Definitely number three.
Yeah, I definitely have him as number three. I don't know who else would be number three. Of course, no Mike on Scotty. Scotty's my favorite player, but Mike's Mike, so duh. One thing about what Derrick Rose brought, I think, to the fandom, the Bulls fandom, is memories. I mean, Dave and I used to hang out and watch Derrick Rose. It was must-watch TV because, you know, not many teams could say they had the best player in the league on your team or the best player on the floor. Mm-hmm. Or the top five player in the NBA on your team. We had that as a Bulls fandom. And so, and not only that, he was special, meant that he's probably the fastest player to ever played in the NBA with the basketball. I have never seen anybody as fast with the basketball. And so, with his height and his unique build, the ability for him to go to the hoop hard and dunk on you. So his whole game was just unique. It wasn't something you kind of never, you didn't really see before. You never seen before. So, it was must watch because you didn't know what you're going to see. You didn't know if the special was going to come out that night. If he's going to make that one great play, that big highlight, seeing a guard his height dunk on somebody or you know, I said this plenty of time to Dave. I think Derrick Rose is the best slow motion player in the NBA. He looks so incredible in slow motion. He can do anything in slow motion. He can drink a cup of orange juice in slow motion and he'll look incredible. So, yeah, definitely Derrick Rose number three.
So those were some extra pieces of audio from the cutting room floor of the Grading Garpack series. I want to wrap this up by just thanking all of the guests we had on, starting, of course, with Jack Silverstein from episode one. Having his insight was so awesome and so helpful for setting the stage. Thank you to Jack. I want to thank our guest graders, Doug Tonis, the Podfather, Mark Karanzoulis in episode two, Big Dave Watson and C-Dub in episode 3. And of course, C-Red Fred, Matt Peck in episode 4. That was a really interesting episode and a fun debate. Everybody that came on was so awesome, so insightful, and so gracious with their time. Because these episodes, some of them we were recording for almost 2+ hours. And, you know, a lot of it didn't make it. But every single one of them was gracious with their time. And I greatly appreciate it, and it was a lot of fun to put this project together. And thank you for everybody that listened. Statistically, we saw a nice upkick in downloads and streams, so huge thank you to all of you listeners of the Rebuildable podcast. We'll be back with our normal episodes the week of September 8th, so the week after Labor Day. We'll be back with our regular episodes of the Rebuildable podcast. So to everybody that listened and contributed, again, thank you so much. Can we go back? This is the moment. Tonight is the night. We'll fight till it's over. So we brought our hands up like the ceiling can't hold us. Like the ceiling can't hold us. Thank you for listening to the Rebuildable Podcast. Be sure to check out more episodes on Google Play, Spotify, Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, and on Rebuildable.com.